Good morning. So this morning I'd like to talk about passion and patience on the path. Passion and patience on the path. Why not? Starting with passion. So I'm going to say that I think both are important. That's what I'm going to say. You can just leave now, if you'd like. Passion. So the root of passion in Latin is passio. I don't know Latin, but to suffer. Oh, okay. Well, suffer. So ardent affection, devotion to some activity. When we're devoted to something, when we've had an ardent affection for something, there's some suffering, usually. There's some suffering. And on the path, on the Buddhist path, the second step of the path, the Eightfold Path, is intention, which sounds kind of dry, but actually, to make it go, it has to be heartfelt aspiration. It has to be have an inspired component to it. I mean, after all, the second step is the one where you look back and you say to yourself, well, geez, I know all this stuff from the first step about the interdependence of all life, about the illusion of ego, monkey mind that dominates. I know all that stuff, and then I'm going to do all those other steps to not be caught by monkey mind anymore. And that takes some ardent commitment to do that, to move as from the suffering, from the dissatisfaction at the beginning of the path, to the sukha, the quiet joy that's always here, which is not at the end of the path, it's just always here, but we miss it. So that takes ardent activity. It takes heartfelt activity to do that. And also personally, our lives are short, and we need to do things that we feel passionately about. If we don't, we kind of waste our lives, and we think, what did I do? I just was going through the motions. So to discover our own passions is pretty important. The things that really, we really care about, that we really, really want to do. That's the heart practice part of Zen. And we all have different passions and different times in our lives, different passions. And they come and go. Sometimes we're trying to figure out what we really care about. Sometimes we've got one, but we're overwhelmed by it. Or we've got too many of them. For the last 10 or 15 years. Well, I've got some other passions too, like my grandchildren, but I'm not going to get into them because I talk about them all the time. But a couple of passions that I've got is that, one, I really want to help people move from fundamental dissatisfaction to discovering the quiet joy that's always here. I really want to help them as a Zen teacher. So I feel passionately about that. And I suffer a little bit because I don't really know how to do it. I don't know if I should talk more, if I should talk less, if I should offer meet with people more, or how to do it. And anything we really care about, we're gonna struggle with. It doesn't matter what it is. And the other thing, my other passion for the last 10, 15 years has been trying to develop services in the community for people with mental illness. And that comes out of my own personal suffering from my brother's suicide and my family. So this time of year, we're ending this time of year, but I'm in my black in the morning with my robe on, and then I go upstairs or rush home and get my sports coat on. And if I have to go to the legislature, I get my tie on, and I'm out there. I'm out there at that legislature begging begging for support. And there's a lot of suffering for me this year, boy. with these Tea Party people who are dominating things at the legislature. And right now, the Senate wants to eliminate funding for crisis services for people with mental illness in the Twin Cities. The House doesn't. So fortunately, I have to spend all my time with these guys who are in the Senate, like the guys and girls, or men and women. And they're mostly new. They mostly haven't been in politics before. You know, they just got elected. They don't, but they got elected. Their vow is to reduce taxes, and I understand that. But geez, and I go into their offices. I was telling this to Rosemary, I think, last week. I go into their offices, the last two offices, and they have crosses on every wall in their offices in the Capitol. And I think, wow, this is a trip. I think, do they know about Jesus? Do they know how Jesus felt about people who were in crisis? But of course, I have to button my lip up. No, that's not going to help. That's not going to help. So passion is important for all of us. It's a driving force for humans. And then there's the dark side of passion. There's the results of letting passion get out of control. Just run its course with nothing to complement it. We're just like wild horses. And even in a good cause, like my cause, which is to help people who are dealing with mental illness get support in the community. Even that cause, if I'm not careful, I'm over there at the legislature and I'm competing against you who are trying to advocate for early childhood education. I'm trying to jump in ahead of you. And you who are advocating for developmental disabilities. Oh, developmental disabilities, they got plenty of money. So I have to be careful because my passions get out of control. Even when I think I'm being a bodhisattva. I start off as a bodhisattva, but how long does it last? So the complement to passion then is patience. And interestingly enough, in Latin, the root for patience is P-A-T-I, which means what? To suffer. Oh, hey, what a deal. To suffer. And here's a definition of patience. Bearing pains or trials calmly, uncomplainingly, exhibiting the power to endure hardship or physical or mental distress. And here's a study which some of you have read about, which I'm going to spend a couple minutes reading to you about patience. 4-year-olds were left in a room by themselves, and a marshmallow was placed on the table in front of them. The child was told to wait by the experimenter, as he had a supposed errand to run. If the child would wait patiently, he or she would get 2 marshmallows, if and only if they did not eat the other one on the table. The child was left in some cases 15 to 20 minutes alone with a marshmallow, an eternity in 4-year-old time. Talk about timelessness, right? If you were that child, would you have waited for the 2 marshmallows, or would you eat the one on the table? The commentator says. In the experiment, some ate the marshmallow and some did not. Of the non-marshmallow eaters, the researcher says, to sustain themselves in their struggle, they covered their eyes so they wouldn't have to stare at temptation, or rested their heads in their arms, talked to themselves, sang, played games with their hands and feet, and even tried to go to sleep. These plucky preschoolers got the 2 marshmallows reward. All the children were then sought out as they finished high school. And the researcher says, those who had resisted temptation at 4 were now, as adolescents, more socially competent, personally effective, self-assertive, and better able to cope with the frustrations of life. They also scored an average of 210 points higher on their SATs and got better grades. Hey. All from learning to be patient. All from learning to be patient. So patience on the path is really important. Really important. Right now there's an introductory to meditation class going up on upstairs, and I've been teaching that. I wasn't teaching that, but I'm teaching it again. But I taught it years ago. I used to teach it. Upstairs, we sit for 8 to 10 minutes. And then I do some nice guided meditation at the beginning and the end so that people don't freak out. You know? So the 8 to 10 minutes with some nice guided meditation. Sometimes in the middle, if I'm feeling, I give a little more guided meditation in the middle to get them through. And I remember doing it several years ago with someone, and then they said, well, what's the next step? And I said, well, the next step is to come down on Sunday morning and sit with the group. The person said, for how long? And I said, well, it's 40 minutes. And the person said, well, is there a guided guidance? I said, no, you just sit. You just sit and you do what I told you about watching your breathing and coming back. And she said, oh, I could never do that. I don't have that much patience. Well, a few months later, she was doing that. This person just kept coming back and kept coming back and doing that. And then a couple of years later, she said to me, well, what's the next step? I said, well, it's obvious what the next step is. You haven't done any retreats. And she said, well, yeah, but retreats. She said, how long is that? And I said, oh, well, we start at 5:50 in the morning, and we're done at 9 at night, and you have plenty of good food, and you get to do walking meditation when you're not sitting. She said, oh, I could never do that. Oh, now she's doing it. This person, I think last year, did about 15 days of the retreats. So we don't know what our capacity is in regard to patience. And Zen meditation takes a lot of patience because of how out of control our minds are, how out of control our wishing and desiring and complaining and pissing and moaning are, right? Out of control. So it takes a lot of patience to come back and come back and come back and come back. So without passion, our lives don't have any meaning and purpose, right? We don't have meaning and purpose. We all need meaning and purpose. We say, oh, Zen is beyond that, just in the moment. Sure, but we're human beings. We have longitudinal lives and time. We want meaning and purpose. We don't want to die just thinking that we haven't done something meaningful. Nobody wants to do that. But without patience, there's no strength. There's no strength in our meditation, in our character, just to be with what we love and come back to it again and again and again, even if it's not satisfying. So we really need both. We really need both. And Aristotle said, what is wanted is appropriate emotion, feeling proportionate to circumstance. When emotions are too muted, they create dullness and distance. When out of control, too extreme and persistent, they become pathological, as in immobilizing depression, overwhelming anxiety, raging anger, managed agitation. Apparently this is a translation of Aristotle. It doesn't sound like the Aristotle I read when I was forced to read, you know, but anyway. Good, huh? Good. So, when we're in a difficult situation, and we're often in difficult situations, often it's which way to go? Which way to go? Should I follow the new passion that's coming up, or should I just be patient with what I've committed myself to? It's a quandary lots of times. Quandary lots of times. For Zen students and for human beings. And I'm in this committed relationship. I've been in this committed relationship for a month now, or 10 years now, or something. But it's lost its passion. I feel like the passion's gone. But I feel some passion with some other potential relationships. Wow, ooh, you know, it feels good. I could be alive again. So, should I be patient? Should I stick with it? Even though it feels kind of dead? Or should I follow the other passion? We never really know, do we? It doesn't matter how long you sit in Zazen, you never really know. I have this job. Oh, I like this job pretty well. Actually, I loved it the first week. But now it's getting so boring. I always say TGIF. I say it on Wednesday. TGIF. TG Friday is coming up on Wednesday. Maybe I should, and I have some passion to do other things. But maybe it would be good practice for me just to come back and be with this. But then will I be dead? My life is short. Maybe I should follow this other passion. It's a real passion. So that's a quandary for human beings, I think. So, in Buddhism we say, pause to investigate the new passionate feelings, roots. What are its roots of the passionate feeling? The passionate feeling to leave this job and go to this more exciting new job, which I don't really know anything about, but I want to go. I'll go to school and I'll do it. How do we know? How do we know? Well, in Buddhism we say, well, look at the roots of the passion. Are the roots of the passion greed, hatred, and delusion? The three, whatever they are, what are they, you guys? Three poisons. Are those the roots? Is there some greed? Is there some hatred? Is there some confusion that's motivating us? Or are we motivated by generosity, love, and clear seeing, which is the opposite? These are called unwholesome dharmas and wholesome dharmas. So are we motivated by what's considered unwholesome, the core unwholesome roots of suffering, or by something more wholesome? Does our passion increase our sense of connection to each other, to ourselves, to the world around us, to plants, to animals, to the sky, or does it decrease it? Check that out. We have to check that out. And still, it's not that easy to fathom, but at least it helps to check that out. So passion is the active principle. It's inspired by the desire to move, by the desire to create, by the desire to be alive. Patience is the passive principle. We disengage from those forces. We don't get caught by them. We refrain from acting so we can see something. So we can see how carried away we get by our passions. And of course, passion can get fixated on trying to be someone, trying to be something. In our culture, and probably in most cultures, but I don't know about other cultures, or, you know, we're expected to be someone, to be something. You know, we should be the... Well, in my family, you know, you had to be a doctor or a lawyer, but that is fairly narrow. In most families, just be something. If you're going to be a musician, be the best musician, be the perfect musician. If you're going to be a parent, be the best parent. And that's fine, but we put so much emphasis on the being something or someone to satisfy our kind of fragile self, sense of self, that we forget the being part. So when I was growing up, there was a house in the neighborhood, a family that lived, and this mother, my mother said to me that she wanted to be more like this mother, this other mother, her name was Nancy. My mother said, she's the perfect parent. Look at how she's the perfect parent. I want to be the perfect parent. But all of us in the neighborhood hated this other mother because she was so perfect. We didn't want to go over and play in her yard because we messed things up all the time. We couldn't even have our dog in her yard. Everything was so perfect. Dead. Perfect is dead. Often dead. But we think that we need to be perfect. And that's just sort of human, what humans are like. But if we come back to the being, itself, which we ignore in trying to be the great Zen teacher, all of you pay attention to me, and I forget being, which is always here, always available, but we don't like just being because being is ambiguous. Being is, we don't know, it makes us feel insecure, it makes us feel like, oh, just being? I should be someone, I should be something. But that's good Zen practice, to just be with the being part. Forget the something. Forget the someone. And then the someone and the something will come. Don't worry. Don't worry. So in Zen meditation, we practice not doing anything. So we can see this addiction that we have to being someone and how fear really drives it. And as much as possible, we learn to settle into our what's called the Buddha nature, our true being, which is non-being, which is just stillness, and which manifests itself as inactivity, as expressive activity through being someone, being something, but without that fixation on that. It gets us. Creates so much additional suffering that we really don't need. So we say emptiness is form. Non-being expresses itself as being. It doesn't worry so much about being perfect or being someone or being something. And in pre-Buddhist India and also post-Buddhist India, Brahma, undifferentiated reality. Emptiness, non-being. But that's one side of Brahma. The other side of Brahma is the bra and the ma. The bra is bursting forth. And the ma is all forms. So undifferentiated reality, nothing there, non-being, bursting forth as all forms, as everything. Even a blinking eyelid. Brahma. Emptiness is form. We don't need Buddhism. They did it much before Buddhism, right? Buddhism came later. But something also came before that. And something came before that. And it's all right here. So, but these teachings help us some. They help us some. And we can discover. We can discipline ourselves and both discover through passionate, patient devotion how to just enjoy our lives a little more. Even if our body is giving in or our mind's giving in. Even if we're prone, just to be with it. Just to be with it. So I want to just finish by poem by Rumi. Poem by Rumi. Yep. Okay. I said to the wanting creature inside me, "What is this river you want to cross?" "There are no travelers on the river road, and no road. Do you see anyone moving around on that bank or resting? There is no river at all, and no boat, and no boatman. There is no tow rope either, and no one to pull it. There is no ground, no sky, no time, no bank, no ford, and there is no body and no mind. Do you believe there is some place that will make the soul less thirsty?" That's why we always want to be someone. We want to be something because we think there's some place that will make the soul less thirsty. Clever beings that we are. "Be strong then. Oh, do you believe that there is some place that will make the soul less thirsty? In that great absence you will find nothing. Be strong then and enter into your own body. There you have a solid place for your feet. Think about it carefully. Don't go off somewhere else. Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in what you are. So, let's see, a couple of things about this. So, and I'm not going to follow the order of the poem. I'm going to do my own order. So the first line, I said to the wanting creature inside me, what is this river you want to cross? Well, there's our passion. There's the second step of the path. What do we really want to do to authentically be in the world? What do we feel passionately enough about that we're willing to ford a river that doesn't have a bridge, that we're really willing to go through a lot of tumult? Each of us has something like that in our lives. Each of us has something. We have to see what it is, and then we have to notice how turbulent the river is and what we're getting ourselves into. not just leap in without really checking it out. But then it's time to do it. We need to just do it. We make the decision, just completely do it. Really give ourselves to that. And then, at the end, so that's the passion part, right? That's the passion part. At the end, be strong then and enter into your own body. This is something I feel like I should say every day to people who are meditating. Every day. This should be there. Be strong then and enter into your own body. There you have a solid place for your feet. Think about it carefully. Don't go off somewhere else. We need to say this to ourselves over and over again. I even do. After 83 years of Zazen, I have to say, don't go off somewhere else. Don't go off somewhere else. Don't go. Patience. This practice takes a lot of patience, you guys. And if you say you don't have it, that's just your concept. What do you mean you don't have it? It's a muscle you develop. You develop this muscle. You develop muscles when you work out. You can develop the muscle of patience if you really care about doing this. It's just an issue about how passionately you care about it. That's all. Be strong then and enter into your own body. There you have a solid place. There's always a solid place here for your feet. Always a solid place. Think about it carefully. Don't go off somewhere else. Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things. So this takes patience, but also passion. Because sometimes those imaginary things need some passionate counterstatement on your part. Because they're coming in, they're inundating you. You're sitting and you feel like, wow, there's another wave, there's another tune, there's another regret. So it takes passion to say, no, I'm coming back to my breathing. No, yes to my breathing, yes. I'm Buddha. I can do it. Everything's Buddha. If there's no passion inside, your sitting just becomes dead. And you become like a dead person. Instead of the life that's always in you, it's always flowing through you, regardless. And then, there are no travelers on the river road, and no road. Do you see anyone moving around on that bank or resting? There's no river at all, and no boat, and no boatman. There's no tow rope either, and no one to pull it. There is no ground, no sky, no time, no bank, no ford, and there is no body and no mind. Well, what's this sound like, you guys? What does this sound like? Rumi. This is Rumi. This is the Middle East. Rumi. This is not the Heart Sutra, but it is the Heart Sutra. This is Zen. This is what we chant every morning. Every morning we chant, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no this, no that, the other, right? On. Stupid, isn't it? But it's not stupid. It's clearing out. It's letting go of all of our all of our judging so that we can experience our original openness. Not original yesterday, but original now openness. The origin that's always here. We experience that by clearing out. And then when we do that in the Heart Sutra, we really come back to Brahma. Even though they deny we're totally non-theistic in Buddhism. We have nothing to do with God or any gods. We come back to Prajnaparamita. Kind of surprising, isn't it? Is Prajnaparamita very different than Brahma? Read about her. She sounds an awful lot like Brahma. How did she get snuck in there in a non-theistic religion? How did she get snuck in there? She's the mother. She's our mama. In the Heart Sutra, we've negated everything, and then we're depending on Prajnaparamita. We're depending on the goddess who is the mother of Buddha and the mother of all life. Whoops, we've gone. Are we Hindus or what? What's the deal here? What are we? Weird stuff. But this is a metaphor that helps us. The life energy that is always pulsing through us. We want to call it our mother, that's fine. Mama, I want to remember you. I want to remember that this energy is here, that it's boundaryless, and yet that it has these boundaries and these boundaries within its boundarylessness, because it's always manifesting itself. Just as it is. And we worship that energy. We worship Prajnaparamita at the end of the Heart Sutra. Some of you guys don't even know what I'm talking about. Some of you know better than you'd like to. Prajnaparamita. We worship her. We worship Mama. But we also celebrate her as ourselves, as everything. We celebrate her. And then we end the Heart Sutra with Bodhisvaha. Awake, yay. Svaha is a Sanskrit exclamation for great joy. Great. Sometimes it's translated as yay. Sometimes as yippee. That's my translation. Sometimes as wonderful, wonderful. It's just being. It's just being which rests on non-being, and which is always expressing itself as life. But there's no end to this path. It's on and on and on. And with our passion and our patience, we appreciate it. We express it. Just more and more it becomes organic. It becomes the way things are. The first step, first we think, well, that's probably the way things are, but it's not the way things are for me. But if it's the way things are, it is the way things are for you. Duh. Okay. That's what I wanted to say this morning. Comments, questions? And on the path, which they say goes on and on as a spiral. Goes on and on. The first step, which starts out so tentatively and so sort of unsure, gradually becomes integrated so that there's a little bit of wisdom. Not a lot of wisdom, but a little bit. You don't need very much. Just think what would, if we had a little bit of wisdom politically, what would we be doing in the world? Just a little bit. Just a little bit in Afghanistan and Israel. What would we be doing if we had a little bit of wisdom? What would it be like? Sure.
That midway through your talk, which I really loved.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I was wondering whether you were going to make any reference to Mother's Day.
Oh, it's today Mother's Day.
And then when you round it out with Prajnaparamita.
Oh, hey, Prajnaparamita Day.
There it is.
Actually,
not only that, but, you know, we're talking about this mysterious consciousness, which we all have. Where did it come from? It came from our mothers.
Oh, good. All right.
Do we need a planet?
Well, actually, I did say to my wife last night, or maybe this morning, I said, I think I said it this morning, today's Mother's Day, isn't it? She said, yes. And her kids might call her, but I'm not going to wait for it. Yeah.
So I was wondering, because I don't know enough about the tradition of Prajnaparamita.
Uh-huh.
Is it traditionally, at least in Soto Zen, seen as a metaphor? Or is she personified? Because I guess the difference for me is how, like in Catholicism, God has to be personified. And how this, like, this divine entity in other cultures, like Lakota, great mystery, great spirit, is not really personified.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Prajnaparamita usually personified as an actual, like...
Well, of course, yeah, that's a good question. Am I interrupting you before you're finishing?
Not really.
Okay. Well, you see images and deities of Prajnaparamita all over the place, even in Soto temples, you'll see them. But, you know, in Zen, everything is metaphorical. It's all metaphorical. It's all story. So I would hope that I would think that people who said Prajnaparamita is real and everything else is delusion or something like that, those people wouldn't be Zen teachers, but they might be.
Yeah, I guess that's my question, because I really appreciate the way that you're doing it. But part of me is suspicious that because you're Lakota, demonic,
influence. Yeah, well, like...
And how many Mahayana Buddhists, you know, there might be a large percentage that kind of sees her as a goddess that is, you're worshipping an actual...
I can't answer that. But I can tell you that both Suzuki and Katagiri thought of her metaphorically. And the Dogen certainly thinks about her. I mean, if you read Dogen, what he does with her, he just plays with her. But it's a good question. It's a good question. It's easy to become fundamentalist in whatever we do. Whatever we do. Buddhism, even Unitarianism. I used to be a fundamentalist Unitarian. It's a different thing, you guys, but there's a fundamentalism in there, too. Different thing, you guys. What else? On Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. The mothers in the room. Happy Mother's Day.